absolutely right. There we are. Session number 72. We're in the Essay and Fundamentals on pages 394. And we're going about to start a new, the last, very last essay called The Unwritten Torah, which is the Torah Shabbal Peh, which is the oral law. And this is the Mishnah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Mount Sinai. And that Mishnah was discussed in the Bota Midrashim in Tiberias. And then written down by Rav Yossi and Rav Munna. And that became the Talmud Yerushalmi. Even though it was written in Tiberias, it was named the Yerushalmi out of deference for the Holy City. 150 years later, Ravina and Rav Ashi in Babylonia did the same note-taking or minute-taking task and ended up with what we have as known as the Babylonian Talmud. Just to give you a bit of a... direction on that, when you open up, this is the Talmud Bavli, which means Babylonian Talmud, not the Talmud Yerushalmi, I don't know if they've got one here, which is the Jerusalem Talmud. We generally go with, I'd say 99.9% recurring cases, with the Talmud Bavli. In fact, so much so, if there's only an inferred source in the Bavli that overrules an explicit source in the Yerushalmi. However, if there's nothing doing in here, if it doesn't talk about something in here, then we will generally adjudicate according to the Yerushalmi. So that is extremely rare. When you open up a Gemara is the Aramaic word for Masaira. The Hebrew word is Masaira. The Aramaic word is Gemara. They both mean tradition. So Gemara just means tradition. You basically have a Masnisin at the top, which means Mishnah. And there was a man that would just recite a Mishnah. It'd be a bass medrash, which looked like a tape player, because he knew the whole thing about players, so he'd just say the Mishnah, play, you know, Ishkar and Godly, he'd just say, blink, press pause, and the Rosh Yeshiva would say, oh, so what do we learn from this? And there'd be a huge tumult from the B'nai Yeshiva, we learn this, we learn that, where do we learn that from? We got sources, etc., the whole argument. And the argument was written down by the minute takers, who in this case was Ravina and Rav Ashi in Babylonia, or Rav Yossi and Rav Munna 150 years prior in Tiberias, and the actual text of that is what we have as the central pillar as the Gemara. So the Talmud is a mixture of the Mishnah at the top and the Gemara, the discussion of the Mishnah and the elucidation of the Mishnah to be able to define the law afterwards. In the Vilna edition of the Shas, which is basically what every Shas you're ever going to see has, they also have commentaries and super commentaries on the same page. On the inside gutter of the page, you will have Rashi. Rashi is always on the inside. And on the outside, you have his grandchildren and other people of that contemporaneous generation who are the Balei Tosfos, some of who lived in Lincoln, York, and Leeds. In fact, if you go to Lincoln, you'll find a road called Jacob's Well Road. Jacob's, which obviously is the first road where there was a mikveh, Jacob's Well Road, right? It's a mikveh there. Can make for this? We're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, before the expulsion of the Jews, and before we were brought back with Menashe Yisrael's intervention with Oliver Cromwell, right? All that business. So that was a Balei Tosfos, the grandchildren of Rashi. Rashi was about the late 1100s, so we're talking about his grandchildren's time. Indeed, one of the biggest Balei Tosfos was Rabbeinu Tam, who was Rashi's grandson, right? Rashi had only daughters. He had only daughters. So that's the Tosfos on this. Now that's more of an argumentative explanation here. It's a very, very difficult Rishon to learn Tosfos. Rashi's there. Then you have super commentaries on the page as well. But the main part of the Torah Shabbal Peh, when you open it up and look at it, is the Mishnah and the Gemara in the central pillar over here. Okay, let's talk about what's going on and dive straight into the text. Highlight. First sentence needs a highlighting. God did not desire to write the Torah so clearly that it would not need any explanation. This is such a bombshell of a statement. And I always get asked, like, why didn't he do that? Why didn't he just write everything out? Absolutely. Mitzvah, 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 mitzvah. Give us 700,000 mitzvahs. Give it all. Don't wait for the Rabbonim to come along and pick apart a Mishnah. Just tell us, for goodness sake. But this is the key, is he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to keep it a closed book for all those that would not delve into, research and toil in it of their own accord. Which means if you do not study the Torah, if you do not delve into it, and as you have learned over Baruch Hashem, these 72-hour-plus sessions, you simply aren't going to get it. You can't take someone who's never been to this course, sit them down, get them to answer, you know, ask a question, just you can't just give over that 72 hours in like, you can't do that. You have to sit for 72 hours. That's how it works. There's a lot of data here. And the reason is, Lefum Sara Agra, according to the exertion is the reward. Hashem did not want to just give it out. You have to toil in the Torah to get it. It's automatic inheritance. I'm Jewish, I'm born, that's it, give me the Torah. No, you're Jewish, you're born, you now have a mitzvah to learn the Torah. And the Torah is yours as a birthright, but it won't just fall into your lap. You've got to delve into it. That's how you crack open the code. Quite to the contrary, says the Ramchal, God wrote it in many undefined concepts. I'm going to need a chumash that's going to come up here. So that nobody could possibly know its true meaning without being given an explanation. You can't just leave a guy alone on a desert island with a chumash and just expect him to get all the law. He's just not going to happen. He's going to need to research. You're going to need the Mishnah. You're going to need to crack into it. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zechut Levracha, used to say that the Mishnah and the Gemara is shorthand, it's like the longhand notes for the Chumash. And the Chumash is the shorthand notes for the Gemara. Because he's thinking, oh yeah, we learned that pasuk, learns out this whole slew of this halacha, and we learned from this extra letter about this. And you only know that from the Gemara. So the Chumash is like shorthand, like a secretary would take shorthand notes for the whole of Shas. The explanation must come through a tradition emanating from God himself, who is the author of the Torah. Which is why the Reform, Conservative, Conservadox, Masorti, et al, etc, 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 are never going to get it. Because their Messiah, their tradition, is new. They're making it up. So they make up their tradition from basically 150 years ago. Yeah, that's it, basically, to 200 years ago, whatever it's going to be. They just made it up. And said, we're going to do it like this. Which means the Messiah isn't going to explain to you what the Torah is talking about. Which is why they've got further and further and further and further from the Torah. The generations have gone down. The original Reform were very much more quote-unquote frum than today's Reform. they considered they were reforming, you know, they didn't reform overnight. And say they didn't just jump away overnight. They began to reform, and where we're at now is centuries later from that reform. Totally devoid of most of the core of Torah. This explanation must come through a tradition emanating from God himself. You're not going to get the Torah any other way. Who's the author? Thus, for example, the Torah speaks of such commandments as tefillin and mezuzah and offers no written explanation of their nature whatsoever. Now, I just want to ask you a question here. Do a social experiment. Write up a book that says you have to do the special carrot mitzvah. A special mitzvah of carrots. You know what I'm telling you about. Then you get 10 people and you teach them the way of the carrot. Oh, and they go and they set up communities, one in Brazil, one in Paraguay. Now, over a period of 3,000 years, the carrots are going to look different. Because one is... Find me wherever you go. Tefillin are black and square and have four compartments and have lots of words written in an exact order, which are exactly the same, with the same letters, in the same font, in the same order, written with meticulous care, stitched with only very specific material, sinews of cows, and rolled in a particular way, and put in the box in a particular way, and donned in a particular... It doesn't say anything about straps! It just says, buy them on your arm. Oh, buy what on your arm? A mikveh in any community. Good to go. A sukkah in any community. Does the Torah tell you what mikveh is? No. Just a kai gosh, a tovel in a mikveh. Tovel in a mikveh. Okay, what about sukkah? No mention. You've got to dwell in a sukkah for 7 days. That's it. What you got to do? Eat matzahs. What's a matzah? Shecht. This is my favourite. This is my absolute favourite. It's got to give me my favourite. I was going to leave this to you, but I can't. Shecht an animal... The way I told you. Sorry, but if you look in the whole Torah, or in the Tanakh actually, anywhere, and it doesn't tell you. No, it's Maseches Cholin. The way I told you, you'll learn about. Shech Tanakh, but if you read the Torah, there's no way. How do you, what? How do you do it? Big club, or you play dance music, or ABBA to it until it dies. What do you do? How do you Shech Tanakh? I don't know. What do you do? No, I'm not telling you. But I told you, but all the communities you go to, and you find that it's exactly the same Messiah. A sukkah is a sukkah in Belgium, in Belgrade, in Johannesburg, in Bolivia, mamish, and they're all measured out, and they got schach, and they're all like, we're exactly half a lovered, and there's everyone's up with the same halachas. It's amazing. It's exactly the same tradition everywhere you go. The secret of this is Torah Baal Peh. This is our secret lifeline into the Torah. And without Torah Baal Peh, you won't have these mitzvahs. You don't know how to do them. The truth is, however, that God actually concealed, meaningfully concealed, directly, l'chachila, ab initio, concealed the meaning of his words for a specific reason and purpose known only to him. That's a service ceiling. Can't go beyond that. Hashem knows what he's doing. He said, I don't want to tell you how to roll a mezuzah. A mezuzah is going to be something you want to put on the door. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'll tell you through the oral law. Why? Because everything that was concealed in the written Torah, however, was taught to Moshe, and from him, the tradition was transmitted orally to the sages of each successive generation. Indeed, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Moshe taught Aaron, Aaron taught Yeshua, Yeshua taught the elders, and everyone taught everyone else. And for 40 years, that's all they did. They didn't have any professions.
No
iPhones. Baruch Hashem. Look, you're right. They did make the Mishkan, which means that but that's Hashem giving them the ability. Their heart told them, I think I could be a tailor. I think I could work with cloth. Or I think I could be a metal worker. So they all got, Hashem gave them magical abilities, as it were, to just basically extend what was naturally in their desire to do so they could help with the Mishkan. But once the Mishkan was up and running, well, that's it. What are you going to do now? You're going to sit and learn. Your food comes to your door. Your clothes never get dirty or wear out. Everything sorted. Your water supply is organized. You have no sewage supply. Mainly no sewage supply because you don't go to the toilet because the man does that. So what are you doing all day? You're learning. That's why it was called the Dor Hadayah, the generation of knowledge. And my goodness, who did they only have around there? Had the best of the best. And if they had a problem, they go to Moshe Rabbeinu. And if he had a problem, which he did on several occasions, he'd ask the boss. He'd just say, good question. Let me ask Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kodesh Baruch Hu would. And he'd give over more of the Torah. It was just stupendously amazing. So it wasn't as if this just happened overnight and one person got. It was 40 years. People were born only knowing this existence. Children grew up not knowing anything but man. This was normal life. In this tradition, the true meaning of the written word is accurately explained. And we therefore know how the mitzvahs must be observed according to God's will. Because that's where the mitzvahs are in the Chumash, right? Now, there are three ways in which the written Torah is modified by its traditional interpretation. I need a pencil. You need to work at this. There's notes here. We're going to be taking a lot of notes. More notes than usual. I need you to write a number one. Number one. There's one, two, and three. Okay. Number one. The first type of group of concepts which are mentioned in a general manner in writing, but whose details are explained in the oral law. E.g. mezuzah. There's something about putting a mezuzah, whatever that, on a doorpost. Yeah? What is that? I'll tell you in the oral law. But at least you've heard about the concept in the written law. I mean, we talk about in the Shema, mezuzah beis sechah v'sherecha, right? You've got to put them on. So what's a mezuzah? If they scroll, okay, fine. So the oral law tells us these scrolls. Okay. So at least it's mentioned. The second category, number two, there's one, two, and three. We're going to refer back to this. So one, two, and three. The second category includes concepts that are fully explained in the written Torah, but which can be interpreted in various ways. So he, let's say, says one thing, and that could mean A, B, or C. In that case, the tradition is the determining factor. We say, the rabbis say, it's C from the Mishnah. So you have to drop A and B in its possible interpretation of what the Torah is saying. We're going to go to examples. You could drop A and B, and the Mishnah says C, so we have to understand the words of the Torah being C. That's another form. So it says it explicitly, but we have to understand that explicitness as being this. We're going to come to examples. The third category, where the actual words appear to have one meaning, while the oral tradition comes along and explains that the desired observance is actually very different from that implied by the obvious meaning. It goes against the words that you would naturally have to... It says one thing, and you would interpret that as A, but we come along and say, actually, you have to completely re-understand those words as B. And if you understand it as A, you're wrong. It's almost misleading in its fundamentalist, pure, just written form. You have to have the oral law to understand it, otherwise it's completely... It just changes its meaning. Regarding such cases, our sages say in Gemara Sota, page 16a, the law supersedes the text. Halacha aikeves esa mikra. The halacha uproots literally the written word. Because the halacha, which means halacha, the way to go, which is what we proceed orally, that's what Moshe Rabbeinu said. What these words mean, when Hashem said that, he meant this. Now that's a Sinaitic tradition. You wouldn't know that unless Moshe Rabbeinu would have told you. It's clear that you would misinterpret that without this tradition. I remember someone asked me, what's the... You know, when we fast, when the Torah was translated into Greek. But there was a great miracle. 70 rabbis were put in locked solitary confinement. And they all came out with the same translation, which to the Greeks was a tremendous thing. They saw it as a tremendous nice. It is. Because if you interpret the Torah, how are you going to translate that into English? Let's say, different people mean different things. When they say different things, so they're the minds. And it's amazing it all came out as carbon copy. So why fast? The reason is like this. Let me explain something to you. I remember back in the day, before Art Scroll came out, you had things like Sonsino, and not only that, early like Oxford, the Oxford Press translation of the Mishnah. And these things were very much looked down upon. Very much looked down upon. Because they're extremely academic, extremely well translated from an academic standpoint. But let me explain to you what's wrong. A guy turns up late for work and his boss asks him, why are you late? He says, I got a frog in my throat. And there's a Chinese guy overhearing this. The Chinese guy's parents say, what happened at work today? The Chinese guy said, and he quite rightly translated, my colleague was late because an amphibian was stuck in his neck. Now that's Emmaus! That's what the guy said! Now, when you translate it in the Oxford Mishnah, Mamish, that you look at the word, and a amphibian was in, and the words for amphibian are used cross-referenced here three times in Nach, and he says, that's not what he means! He means he's Hazardic, you know, he's got a sore throat. There's no frogs. There's no frogs in there. But he said, there is a frog in my throat. Yes, that's a way of saying the guy's got a sore throat. But if you directly translate that into another language, and it is accurate, an amphibian was in his neck. Now, some say it's a frog. Others might have translated it as crocodile. Others might have translated it as lizard. There's an argument according to a subgenre of translation from the Greek entomological thing that really it was a newt. But let's not split hairs, so we're going to call it an amphibian. An amphibian for sure it was, and it was in his neck. The whole thing's rubbish. It's nothing to do with amphibians. It's, yes, you're right, you can translate academically brilliantly, it's a new to, but that's meaningless. The thing is, what you should translate it as, she had a sore throat. What about the frog? You've got to understand the frog's not there. It's an expression, there's no frogs. But it says frog. Yeah, but you're missing it. You understand what I'm saying? That's where these translations fall down. A good translation of Torah, such as by Arya Kaplan's The Living Torah, which is absolutely accepted to be the best English translation of the Torah ever, And coming in a close second is Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's translation, but that's into English from classical German. So you lose again, there's a translation plus a translation, you get a bit of a carbon copy, like photocopy of a photocopy, loses a bit of a resolution. This is as good as get. Why? Because he takes into account the Gemara and our tradition and translates it as accurately. If there's not an Oxford Press translator who says, this is terrible. Clearly that's not what the words are. That's right, because he's got it right, because he really understands what the words really mean. Even though it says there's a frog in his throat in the actual text, he would translate it as the guy had a sore throat. He's got it. He's nailed it. That's the translation that we need. So sometimes you have to release the actual words from your understanding what's being said and understand the tamsit, what the Torah is really saying. You can only know that through the Messiah. We can only trust that directly from Moshe Rabbeinu, not how you feel or how some reformed rabbi feels in Berlin. It's got to be from Moshe Rabbeinu himself, direct from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is our tradition. That's what we got from Mount Sinai. Now, not many cases, however, are included in this category. These are relatively rare. Furthermore, if a person delves really deeply into it, he'll discover that the literal meaning of the text doesn't contradict the law completely. Rather than contradicting the law and being completely opposite of the law, the text can still be interpreted so as to agree with it, at least in some aspect and within some limited sense. Now, I'd like to give you some examples. Give me a minute. Parshas Kisetse in Devarim, and we're in Chaf Beis 22, Yud Zion 17. Okay, this is the defamation of a married woman. Let me just give you some background. If a man marries a wife and he comes to her and hates her, and he makes a wanton accusation against her, spreading a bad name against her, and he said, in order to get out of this situation, I married this woman and I came near to her and I did not find signs of virginity on her. This is when he married her, and contractually she was being married as a basula, as a virgin, and he says she wasn't a virgin, she was loose. And the whole thing's a lie. In which case, it's a mekachtos. It's a contract which was bound on a premise which doesn't exist and is false, and therefore he wants to get rid of her. Then the father of the girl and her mother should take and bring proofs of the girl's virginity to the elders of the city, to the gate. The father of the girl should say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as a wife, and he hated her. That's their case. Now behold, he made wanton accusation against her, saying, I did not find signs of virginity on your daughter. But these are the signs of virginity on my daughter. And they should spread out the sheet before the elders of the city. Now the Torah would never put a woman through a situation where a matrimonial bedsheet needs to be put out in front of anyone. But this is what the Torah seems to be saying, doesn't it? What's the signs of virginity? This, Rashi says, is clearly a euphemism. Rashi explains, spreading out the sheet means laying forth the case as clearly as spreading out a sheet. So there's no creases or wrinkles or folds or pleats where you're hiding the truth. She was a virgin, 100% this is the case. The marriage said, he's got a problem. He didn't like it. He had an argument with her before. Everyone knows that. He just wanted to get rid of it. He just wants, you know, to not pay kasuba. Clearly, this does not mean that that's what's going on. And Rashi explains that. So that's one example where the words are not fitting what it actually means. It doesn't mean they have to bring any form of linen or bed linen or anything. It means they have to bring all case evidence and spread the sheet of the case. Why did the Torah use such words? So that you won't understand the Torah without the tradition. You won't get it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want you to get it without the tradition. It's two parts. The oral law and the written law are two components of one living being. You need a Sefer Torah and a set of Shas. And then you can understand what Hashem wants from you. Otherwise, you're not going to get it. Okay, I have... So that's a mushal. That's an analogy. And it's not to be taken at face value. That is an example of type 3. That's a type, just me, that's a type 3 example. What's a type 3 example? Where the actual words appear to have one meaning, while the oral tradition explains that the desired observance is very different from the implied and obvious meaning of the. So that's why. That's Deuteronomy 23:17. To you as a good boy you were. So if you've been a good boy, you just used to put your hand outside the tent, pick up the man and eat it. But if you've been a naughty boy, you might be down the street. So you'd be like very sheepishly walking down the road. It was like, something. That's why they complained. They hated being so transparently open with one another to their spiritual standing. It was a very difficult place to live because I don't feel comfortable like that. Shemos 22:1, chapter 22, verse 1, which is in Parshas Mishpatim. Next week, so we're in Yisrael now, coming up. Mishpatim is next. It says like this. It's a famous problem of terrorist thing from Gomorrah Sanhedrin. A thief digging in. This is, by the way, a very modern thing where they asked Rav Yosef Zochatzal in the Kodesh Levrach. Unbelievable, what a mind he was. They asked about the Arabs, the Palestinians. Palestinians, they're Jordanian nomads, they're Palestinians. They're from Jordan. Jordan want them back. Palestinians, they took on that word for Lishtimach. They're digging in tunnels into Israel, and the Israelis blow them up. And the kashrus, is that legal? The Torah talks about such a thing. Chapter 22, 1. If a thief is discovered... By the way, what's armed robbery called in the Torah? Hamas. There was Hamas in the world. That's why the flag was brought. Unbelievable they call themselves that. Can you believe that? They're going to set up their friends with Gezel and Geneva. They've got great... Instead of Hezbollah, we'll have Gezel and Geneva. So if a thief is discovered while tunnelling in, and he is struck and dies, let's say by you. So he's digging in, and you go down there, and you take a gun, and you shoot him in the tunnel. And he didn't do anything to you. He's sitting there with a spade, and you get in there with another spade, and you shoot him through the hole, and he drops dead. What does the Torah say? There is no blood guilt on his account. It's fine. Why? Because if he's digging into your house, guaranteed to mind back, if he gets into your house, he'll kill you. So you're saving your own life. It's like, so Rav Avad Yosef said like this, if you've got a terrorist with a bomb back on him, and he's digging it, and he's tired, so he stops with his thermos flask, and his sandwiches, and a newspaper, and a little stool, and an evening standard, and a cigarette. And he's going to have a lunch break, yeah, an hour off, right, before he gets digging again. If you go in there and kill him there, you're absolutely fine, because all he's doing is taking risks from killing you. The fact he hasn't killed you yet doesn't mean he doesn't have murderous intent. So you're already doing an act of self-defense, killing him in that situation.
It's very logical.
I had a rabbi in yeshiva that told me, I'm not PC, I'm AC. I'm absolutely correct because I've got the Torah. You're right, it's not PC, and I am vertically challenged. I'm short, okay? That's what I am. Just call it straight. The Torah is telling you absolutely straight. This man wants to kill you. If he takes a stop and has, I don't know, a sandwich, you can kill him. Because he's just recharging his batteries to get close to you to kill you. But!
He's on his way to kill you.
Mm. But the next pasuk says something which you can completely take out of context. It says, now listen to the words. If the sun shone upon him, there is blood guilt on his account. Oh, you can't just kill him if the sun shone. Now, basic understanding of the text would be, but if, let's say, he popped out and it was a sunny day. it was a really sunny day. I was like, well, bonkers, right? So the sun is shining down, he's got a gun and he's about to get into your house to kill you. But the sun's shining upon him and then you chuck a rock on his head and it kills him. Well, you just murdered a man. Woo, you're in trouble. That's what it says, right? That's not the understanding of the... According to Rashi, this term is allegorical. It's another moshul. If it is as clear as the sun is shining, that the intruder means no physical harm to the victim at all, as clear as it would be that the sun shining brings healing to the world, then it's forbidden for you to kill him. An example given by the Gemara, what would exact... Now, it's like this. If a thief is tunneling into your house, as opposed to knocking on your door, we know the Torah is telling you he has murderous intent. If he finds you, he'll kill you. If he's going to such extremes to get into your house, he'll kill you. A guy who's opportunistic, just checking the door to see if it's open is one thing. A guy tunnelling in with tools, if he finds you, will kill you. So if you kill him, it's an act of self-defence, even if he didn't at that moment threaten you. But if it's your dad, who you are on relatively good terms with, I don't know what dad would be. If it's your father, or someone that clearly loves you, then you can't do it. Because clearly he would never mean to hurt you. He's okay, he's got problems. What is he doing tunnelling into your house to steal from you? You're right, there's issues here that need to be worked out, possibly with mediation. Okay, you need someone to say that again. Why didn't you knock on the door? Why has he got this back? Yes, you're right, but he's not going to kill you. He's not going to kill you. If you know as clear as day that the perpetrator really genuinely means no physical harm, then you can't kill him. And if you do kill him, you're a murderer. That's what it means if the sun shone upon him. Now, if you take that at base reading, we'll be taking in judgments and asking for meteorological forecasts of that particular day and CCTV footage to see whether or not it was sunny that day. Well, it was sunny that day. You killed him. Yeah, but I didn't know this. I didn't know who it was. Yeah, but it says the sun shone. That's not what we're talking about. If you take it at face value, you're getting it wrong. You're getting it wrong. When it says a sun shone upon a tunneling thief, it doesn't mean that, right? It means that the sun, Onkelos, who is the Greco-Roman general who converted and his translation is now next to the Torah in almost every Chumash, he understands that witnesses observe the thief. And therefore the reference to the shining sun suggests figuratively that the event occurred during the day when there were witnesses who saw the burglar. Under those circumstances, he would not dare kill the householder because he'd be killed for it. So what does it mean, shining sun? He was rather than a cat burglar working at night. That's the Ramban that gives Unkelos' explanation. Either which way, it's not what the Pasuk says. The Pasuk is talking about a weather condition affecting what's going on. And the mitzvah is, if the sun shone on him, as opposed to like light spells of rain, then you can't kill him. Which means you're more likely to kill someone in England than you are in Arizona, right? Because the sun hardly, especially if you live in Manchester, the sun hardly shines. Where is the sun? He's on holiday, right? But that's not what we're talking about, Bichlal. Don't understand those. You have to understand the oral tradition to understand those very words. You had a question.
You answered it, because I was going to ask you how does Ramban cope with this, because he always did it literally.
I just quoted the Ramban quoting Onkelos. So again, even though he likes to see things beautifully literally, he's got to go with our Messiah. The Ramban has to fit with the Messiah. He's not going to go against the Messiah. That's what gives him such strength. He's always with the Messiah.
How does he cope with the virgin wife then?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. But nobody argues that it's not an actual sheet, because that would prove nothing. Right. That would they actually talk about it. If you bring a sheet with stains on it, what does that prove? It doesn't prove anything. It's meaningless. So it's clearly not what the Torah is talking about. Clearly not what the Torah is talking about in that case. Again, those were two examples. Those are two separate examples of where the actual words are totally not what the mitzvah means. And that's why you must have an oral tradition. Because if you read it without it, you're going to make a mistake. That's the key what we're learning here. Among the things that we know from tradition...
Well, can I ask you, what about the middle one, number two?
Concepts that are fully explained in the written Torah. Okay, that's further example. I think maybe he's actually going to get to it later.
Okay.
Among the things that we know from tradition is the fact that God, who's the author of the Torah, wrote it in a specific manner following definite rules. Rules that we can only use in order to understand it. Indeed, in the morning we've got the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone, which is basically a stone which had Egyptian hieroglyphs and the translation into Greek. And therefore, once we knew the Greek, we could figure out the hieroglyphs, and finally gave us an in to understand the hieroglyphs. You've got the code, you've got the cipher. We have a cipher which is an introduction to the Sifra, right? Which is a halachic medrash. And it says, Rabbi Yishmael says, through 13 rules, Bishlosha Esri Midas HaTorah, there's 13 hermeneutic principles that allow us to understand the Torah. And we say, if on the Ars Goscinna page 48 in the morning, just at the end of Carbonus, we say there's through a conclusion inferred from a lenient law to a strict one and vice versa, through a tradition that similar words in different contexts are meant to clarify one another, through a general principle derived from one verse and a general principle derived from two verses, through a general statement limited by a specification, through a specification broadened by a general statement, through a general statement followed by a specification followed in turn by another general statement, you may only ever infer whatever is similar to the specification. And he goes through the rules. And he gives this all examples in the text at the bottom. You can only understand the Torah like this. The Torah is written according to these hermeneutic principles. And the Torah is meant to be understood like that. That's why we know in the Ten Commandments, by the way, the word leisignai, don't steal, is sandwiched in between adultery and murder. So because it's sandwiched in between adultery and murder, we also learn out that signai means you've got to die for it. But theft, if you steal, you pay dalet v'had. You've got to give it back and play by, you know, the principal plus a fourth or a fifth, depending upon what it is you stole, right? So what is the only theft where you could get killed for it? That's why we translated this kidnapping. That's an oral tradition because of the hermeneutic principle. Which in between, why would it be there? Well, who says, so our rules that we've given over, no signal over here, you shouldn't. That's got to be a capital punishment of theft. The only capital punishment there is stealing a human being and dafka getting them to do something for you. If you just take a person in a car and drive them, you're not over the death penalty. You're right, you stole that person, like they were on their way to something, you're making them late for something. Don't be fucking sure. Which is terrible, don't do it, okay? Don't go around doing this. But if you kidnap them and then say, right, sew me on a button, or dig a hole in my garden, or paint my car, or do something, using them for some kind of service or something like that, that's absolutely a death, that's capital. And we learn that out from his position in between. That's a hermeneutic principle. We can only understand the Torah with the way the Torah itself discusses it. When we want to understand the intent of its author, when we learn the Torah to understand what Hashem wants, we must follow, and I'm adding in a word, only these rules in delving into the Torah. Don't make up your own rules. That's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Because once you break down the Messiah, you're breaking down the dishes like an enzyme which will break down the whole chain reaction. You know, people who are hemophiliacs, there's many different blood clotting factors. Different people are missing different factors. The most common one to be missing is factor 8. But some people are missing factor 4. You've got a... Factor 11. Think of it as dominoes in a domino rally. Imagine you have 12 dominoes. And in order to drop down the 12th domino, you have to push the first domino, which pushes down 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12. And the 12th won't fall down unless all of the present. If you take out the 8th domino or the 4th domino, when you press down the domino, it'll stop at that point. And it will not create the chain reaction. That's how hemophilia works. There's one factor missing and therefore the blood doesn't clot. You take it, so you have to put that domino in with a transfusion and put that in so that the body can carry on, like putting the domino in. That's how hemophilia. If you start adding in your own rules or taking out the Torah's rules, the whole thing falls to bits. The domino rally won't work. You're either putting in dominoes that don't work or taking them out. It won't chain reaction. That Torah will fall. You won't understand what the Torah is saying. Be extremely careful about that. Which is why the rabbis are so concerned when someone comes up with a novelé. We're always looking in the book for approbations. Who says this is true? Where's the Messiah? Who did this person come from? You want to write a book? Tell me what bottom you're attached to. Where'd you get this from?
That's what's happened with the rabbi in America who converted.
He's out the Messiah. You make it up as you go. You make it up as you go.
Yeah.
We can't add any other rules for delving into it. We have to use that what's given to us. Even though it may be possible to explain a passage in the Torah in a way that fits every single word without resorting to these rules, the interpretation won't be correct. You should know, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, has no pshat. which is why a direct word-for-word translation is bad. Now, in the early Oxford Press, Song of Songs, a very passionate translation comes across. But that's not pshat. You have to learn it as an allegory. Shir Shirim has no pshat. If you learn pshat, it's wrong. You may say, look, but that's what the words are saying. That's not what it means. That's why Art Scroll, who are very, very, they have a lot of integrity to our tradition, they've translated Shir Shirim in this book on Erev Shabbos, you meant to say Shir Shirim, according to the Pshat of Rashi, according to Rashi's interpretation of Shir Shirim. He says he knows how it's meant to be read. Now, if you want to do exact translation, you'll find the words do not match up. But that's because that's what the words are talking about.
Three types
of mitzvahs.
Where does a simple translation error come in?
A translational error?
Yeah.
No, I'm not going into translation. What we have to talk about here is we're not translating. What we're doing here is talking about the original text in its original form being understood on the level of pshat, of simple interpretation of the words. Often, or most of the time, it is pshat. But some of the time, there are three options as to the fact that it isn't pshat. Either it's only a partial pshat, like mezuzah, and there's a lot more to learn. Or it could be the Torah gives over a lot of pshat, but actually one of the interpretations is emes and the others aren't. Or it says pshat in one thing, but that's completely wrong. It talks about spreading out the sheet and the sun shining, and it's got nothing to do with sheets. All the weather conditions. It means an allegory. There it's not pshat. It goes to remes. It's going to a hinted allegorical meaning. There's no translation here. It's just directly in the text understood in its original absolute lexicon. Now, this is true even when the interpretation seems to fit the words more easily than the predicted rules. The rule may come along and say, look, it doesn't mean spreading the sheets. Means spreading the case. It actually means spread the sheet. That's wrong. You want to fit it with the words. You want to shtim it with the words. Make it fit with the words more. Because you like that. Because you want to feel more fundamentalist. You want to feel that's what the words say. So that's what the words mean. Well, that's wrong. Because the Torah tells us that's what it means. It doesn't mean that. The oral law is telling you it does not mean that. Even though you are super, it says the sheet. So I want to see a piece of linen. Or some fabric. That's not what the author of the Torah's intent. We're coming back to a frog in your throat. You, Mamish, want it to be an amphibian. Because it says the word frog. You're missing the point. That's not what the Torah means. That's not the language of the Torah. The language you're talking about is all throughout with a frog in the throat. That's not what it means. You're missing the point completely if you translate it as a frog.
Why? Can I ask why?
The real reason why Kodesh Baruch Hu utilized a frog in my throat instead of saying he had a sore throat is really known only to him. However, as I did say in the introduction, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is speaking in a language he wants us to understand, but he's not willing to give over the rules of that language in the original text. It has to come along in the oral law, which was not allowed to be written down. That keeps the Jewish tradition separate from everyone else in the world. The Gentiles will therefore have no access. God was fully aware that the most published book in the history of humanity, the most printed literary work that there has ever or will ever be, is the Old Testament. There's more Old Testaments printed than any other book. Which means a lot of people have got access to the Torah or a translation of it. But you haven't got access to the explanation. So it's a closed book. Because you ain't going to get it. You ain't going to get it. You're missing 50%. You're missing the oral explanation. Aye, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, what are you doing writing it down? You're not allowed to write it down. He had to preserve the Messiah. He saw the people posh forgetting it. The Romans are coming over. It's all over. If I don't write it down, no one's going to know it. Tradition. They're losing the Messiah. They're losing the tradition. Well, I've got to write it down. So he did it for the sake of the Torah itself. People would know that, look, at the end of the day, it's all in books now for us. It wasn't like that. It was only people's heads. Transmitted from father to son, from father to son, from Mount Sinai. This is what the Torah is saying. This is what it means. There was no sets of Mishnahs from Art Scroll. You understand what I'm saying? It was just that was the implicit understanding familiarly, and it would not be known about that to anyone outside the clan.
It's much easier to accept that and to look upon that when you think that these people were in the desert for 40 years. Like you say, everything was supplied for them. They had nothing else to do but learn Torah.
That was their job, by the way. And the reason they had to learn Torah like that is because God was leading them to Israel to live a normal life. Which is why the Meraglim, the spies who were sent out, rebelled. Because who wants to leave the incubator? You just got it. So you're sitting so pretty in such a perfect environment. I don't want to have to go and hoe and plow and reap and winnow. I don't want to do any of that. I want to sit, mamish the man falls from heaven, and we'll sit and learn it's Gvaldic. Why do I want to change? I don't rock the boat. Go, what are we going to have to do now? I'm going to be a carpenter? How am I going to learn Torah? The rules and procedures that make up this understanding are known as the 13 formulas, the 13 hermeneutic principles, which is quoted you from the Sifra, Rabbi Yishmael Eimer. And that's how the Torah is interpreted together with all of its details and in no other way. You can't make up, well, the first letters spell the word banana. And if they do, it's always talking about fruits, because I like the idea. Have you got a Messiah from Moshe Rabbeinu? Does it say that anywhere? No, then we reject it. It is also necessary to know that the main laws involved in both the positive and negative commandments are all known by tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu. Nevertheless, our sages had a tradition that concepts contained in the oral tradition are also alluded to in the written Torah in various ways, according to various formulas known to them. I.e., if you learn the Torah correctly, if you really understand it, it's actually pointing you, because of the way words are written and there's words linked across Tanakh, that it points you to say, this is not, it's not the posh pshat of the words. This is actually, there's something more going on here. And it would be already putting you, alluding you. It's almost like a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of thing. The Torah is saying, spread the sheet out. Or the sun shining. Now, that wink, as it were, is not something that you're going to get off the text. It's like a subtext that you have to understand when someone's talking to you. They don't mean what they're saying. There's a double meaning that we have to understand. The Torah itself is already giving that over. It was well known and agreed upon by them that God desired that they involve themselves in this area, demonstrating where elements of the unwritten Torah are alluded to in the written Torah. All of our sages therefore strove to seek out these allusions in the manner that appeared most fitting. And that's the Gemara. That's the Gemara. This is why many times in the Talmud we find discussions seeking out such proofs. One wants to say, the Mishnah means this because I've got a pasuk that backs me up. And someone say, you can't use that pasuk because we've already used that verse to tell us something else. So it's used up. I've got a brisa. I've got an external piece of tiniatic material, a piece of material that was quoted by a Tana, like a Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Eliezer kind of level sage, and that was not included in the formulation of the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda Nashli, so it wasn't a Mishnah. So therefore it's called a Brisa, or external, like leftover. And that Brisa says this, which explains what that pasuk means. And they then argue it out, saying, no, that Brisa doesn't mean that, because my Rebbe said that that Brisa actually means something else. Until they come to a conclusion, a legal conclusion, where there's a legal knockout blow to say, yes, we can utilize that brisa to explain that pasuk, which means that pasuk means this. In many cases, there's a dispute regarding the proof itself. Who are you to bring that brisa? My Rebbe says you can't bring that brisa like that. There are many cases where the proofs do not seem to fit very well into the literal meaning of the passages in question. The idea, however, is the same as discussed earlier. The law itself was known from tradition anyway. And they were merely attempting to find an allusion to it in the written Torah according to the 13 hermeneutic principles set down above. It's almost like playing, it's almost like a bit like playing Jeopardy. You know the answer. We know, you know, there's a joke. This is a joke, okay? It's a joke. I'm putting forward a joke. I'm not trying to be, it's a joke. There was a joke that rabbis got together to, find out whether or not God exists, and they thought maybe he doesn't, but then they all had to stop to daven mincha. Right? So, of the chas v'shalom that rabbis should think, you know, what does that mean? It means we all know that God exists. But find me proofs, right? Then the truth is, like, we got the answer. The answer for this particular mitzvah is we know how mitzvahs, because my daddy made the mitzvah, his daddy made the mitzvah, all the mitzvahs are like that. So we know the mitzvahs are like that. But how does the Torah tell us the mitzvahs are like that? So find me proofs. So this proof is like this, that proof is like this. He says, no, we learn it out from this. It's a pasuk in Tanakh, that's learned out. It's actually a bright, or it's a halacha, it's a halacha Moshe Masinai, it's a Sinaitic tradition. Where does it come from? Who says what? Where do we get that Messiah from? We know, though. It doesn't mean we know how it's done, but we want to find proofs written from the Torah as to how it works. Now, in such cases, the sages did not intend that this be the literal meaning of the passage when taken in context. The intent was that this is what God, the author of the Torah, wanted to imply in the written word, following the procedures used for such allusions. When you have a mitzvah, which it is not exactly word for word what we know the mitzvah to be, then we have to understand why that is and what the Torah wants from us and why it is we should now, why the tradition says it's not like that. This is an addition to what Hashem wished to express in the literal meaning of the passage. So first of all, he said it in one way, but he meant something else. Why did he do that? Well, why did he use those words even? If he meant spread the sheet, or he meant the sun is shining, and he really didn't mean that, then why didn't he say other words like open the umbrella or peel the banana? He had to have meant something by saying sheet and sun shining. So what do we learn out from that? There's additional things we learn. But that doesn't mean that becomes the actual literal meaning of the text. That's not the literal meaning. We know that not to be the literal meaning of the text. But now that he has said spread the sheet or the sun is shining, there's got to be things to learn from that too. Sometimes this is called a support, a legal support, known as an asmachta, a rabbinic buttress to support the actual ruling for such a given law. All this relates to the commandments and laws of the Torah. Now, with respect to the non-legal parts of the Torah, by the way, 90% of Shas, good stat here for you, want to jot it in. 90% of the Talmud is practical legality. 90. But 10% of Shas is a gadata. Is kind of like medrash. Stories and code of what I call codified stories. There's a fantastic, if you're into an English book, there's a fantastic book called The Juggler and the King, which is written, I think, by Aaron Feldman, and it's available by Feldheim, which goes through the Ramchal's way of understanding the Gadatas and the Vilna Gaon's way of understanding the Gadatas. Famous stories in the Gemara, like there was a juggler who was juggling goblets of wine while he was jumping over a river of wax. Now, those stories, they're not, that doesn't mean there wasn't a man who was juggling cups of wine jumping over a river of wax. They're extremely deep ideas, hashkafic ideas, philosophical ideas, brought in Shas in an encoded way. An encoded way. It is a fascinating book to go into that, but that's 10% of the Gemara. 10% of the Gemara is philosophical ideas encrypted in an extremely deep cipher, which have to be unraveled and make huge concepts. Literally write books on each story. But that's 10%. That is the agadata. With respect to the non-legal parts of the Torah, oral law, known as the agadata, which is approximately 10% of Shas, which is Shisha, Sidra, Mishnah, the six orders of the Mishnah. There are other principles, which I, the Ramchal, have discussed in a separate essay on the agadatas. And that is actually included in the back of the book, The Juggler and the King. It's translated. It's not in this book. It's a separate essay on Agadatas as to how to answer Agadatas, written by the Ramchal on those elements of Shas. And if you want to get a copy, it's translated and in the back there. It isn't in here, but he's alluding to that, and that's the work he's alluding to. What we will do next time is discuss the laws handed down by tradition, and some even that the sages themselves have decreed. Rabbinic laws. Laws which the Torah never said you to do. But laws which the rabbis came up with completely themselves in order to act as a fence to protect the Torah. A boundary around the Torah to prevent an individual from tripping up in the actual laws of the Torah. Now the Torah itself wants the rabbis to do this. It actually says explicitly, protect my Torah. Okay, b'vakasha. But it doesn't say do this particular thing. It left it to the rabbis as to what it is they're going to do. And gave them legitimate authority to do that on their own governance, obviously using the traditions that are set out. So what we're going to do there is, next time, is discuss the Madurabonons, the rabbinic laws, and how that fits into the unwritten law of the Torah as well. And that, I think, then will conclude the, it's quite a long essay, will conclude the entire essay, and we'll finish the entire work next week. I look forward to meeting with you.